Good afternoon, morning, and evening to everyone. Thank you for coming. Some people asked me for my email address during the last lesson, so I just put it here on the chat. I'd like to briefly recap what I talked about last week and sort of introduce the course for a second time. Part of what I'd like to do in these first introductory comments is reframe what I'm actually trying to do in this course and what I'm not trying to do. So I'd like to just note that most of my professional career I've spent in an academic writing and studying of Jewish history and Jewish thought and Hasidism in particular. The books that I've written, my first book was about Rav Nachman of Breslov, and my second book was about a branch of Polish Hasidism in the 19th century, Ishbitza Radzin. And my third book is about a Hasidic commentary on the Torah. In all of those books, I tried to combine an academic approach using scholarship to Hasidism, together with attention to more contemporary issues that I think are relevant to people looking for spiritual development and for a meaningful religious life. So that's what I've done actually most of my life. I've spent writing and with myself and my ideas and teaching in academic frameworks. The opportunity that I find here in meeting with you is to sort of branch out and actually make some of the insights that I've come to into a message that can be available toward for a wider audience, perhaps people who are less interested in academic studies of Hasidism. And for that reason, this course that I've limited to the first generation of Hasidic teaching is meant essentially to try to understand what it is about Hasidism that might be meaningful for spiritual seekers or religious or non-religious people in the 20th century, 21st century. So what I'm not trying to do in this course is to talk about living Hasidim. I'm not talking about economics or demography or politics or sociology or all of the many questions that people wrote about in the chat and proposed to me. So I just, you know, it could be that if you're looking for answers to that sort of questions, you're not going to find them in this course. So I'm putting that on the table because I think that if we refocus or put our attention in the right direction, there's an opportunity to gain a lot more from what it is that I'm trying to do. Okay, so our topic today is I want to talk about the personalities in the first generation of Hasidism. Specifically, I want to talk about the figure of the Baal Shem Tov as a historical figure and as a presence in the life of those who knew him. And specifically, I'd like to talk about the master-disciple relationship, or the teacher-student relationship. I'd like to talk about the dynamic between the Baal Shem Tov and those who knew him and learned from him in order to try to understand what it was or is about Hasidism that exerted such a spiritual force that made it a continual presence in the Jewish world over the next 250 years. I just like to recall my title of this series, which is How the Baal Shem Tov Changed the World. I do believe that the Baal Shem Tov changed the world. And as I mentioned last week, the world that we're talking about is both the Jewish world and the historical world and internal worlds, people's internal worlds. So in order to sort of ease us into the topic that I'd like to discuss, I want to just dwell for a minute on this question a subject that I think is relevant to all of us, which is what kind of people have influenced us? In other words, if I ask you personally, you know, think about a figure in your life who changed the course of your of your life, your decisions. It could be a family member, it could be a teacher, it could be a colleague or a friend, someone in your life who you feel had a very, very strong influence that remains or that caused a change in your self-development. I'd like you really just to dwell on that for a minute. Think about who such a which person that was, and think for a minute about what personal qualities that person had that enabled them to make such an effect on you. I'm actually going to just give you a minute. Please write it down. You're welcome to share in the chat if you want to, who the person was and what it was about them that gave them the power to affect you. Okay, really just a minute, but I sort of want to focus our thoughts so that I can put it into a context. Okay, that'll be a quick minute because I don't know. Anyway, thank you for those of you who have written. It'll be interesting to sort of look afterwards and see what sort of characteristics resonate with the ones that I want to talk about. Our first topic will be the Baal Shem Tov himself and the question of his presence as a myth and as a historical reality. Before we move on to our sources, I'd like to just dwell for a moment on the Baal Shem Tov's name. It's called the Baal Shem Tov. What exactly is the meaning of that name? And more in terms of history, who was a Baal Shem? What were the Baal Shem? So we know that in other generations before the 18th century, there were various figures who were called Baal Shem, meaning that people who had mastery of the name, of the names. In this context, we're talking about the holy names, God's names. The people who had mastery of the names were people who had mystical knowledge. They used those names, for example, in writing amulets, in exorcism, in various magical or mystical kinds of activities called practical Kabbalah. And those people were called Baal Shem, masters of the name. Now the Baal Shem Tov he has an added element to his title, which is the master of the good name, the Baal Shem Tov. But the point of correspondence between these other historical Baal Shem and the Baal Shem Tov is that apparently the Baal Shem Tov also had access to this Kabbalistic mystical knowledge, which enabled him to heal people. Now, one explanation of this sort of healing is a magical, mystical kind of healing. But as we'll see, the Baal Shem Tov was also a healer of souls in the sense that he had a special understanding of the human soul. Before we get to that point, though, I'd just like to share my source sheet here with you and move on here to this main question of how the Baal Shem Tov as a historical figure was actually discovered. So one of the major scholars who rescued the Baal Shem Tov from this question of historical reality, whether the Baal Shem Tov was actually a real figure, the scholar who saved him from the realm of myth alone was Moshe Rosman. In his book, really a path-breaking book called The Founder of Hasidism, A Quest for the Historical Baal Shem Tov. This is one of the findings that Rosman presented, which really transformed the face of scholarship. Until that time, until Rosman did his research in archives in Poland, many historians believe that the Baal Shem Tov perhaps didn't even exist, or that he had been invented through generations of Hasidim who needed a leader, and so they sort of created him as a fiction. What did he find? He found here this list from 1760, a register of the Jewish residents of Medjugorje, where the Baal Shem Tov lived for 20 years. And here you see in 993 that it says, Balzam Doktor, Dr. Baal Shem, he's exempt from taxes. So this document proved to be sort of transformative in the scholarship of Hasidism and proved that the Baal Shem Tov was a real person. He was a real person. He didn't have to pay taxes. He was a doctor, a medical doctor or a quack doctor. It doesn't matter. But he was recognized as in the Jewish community of Medjugorje as a legitimate citizen who, because of his services, was exempt from taxes. Okay, so what I'd like to continue now and look at some of the other sources that we have about the Baal Shem Tov that give us some insight on his social dynamics and on his self-perception or the way that he was presented and how he emerged in order to change the world. I'd like to present three different kinds of sources. The first one is what's known in Hasidic history and in general scholarship as the Holy Epistle. It's one of the very few documents that we have that was actually written by the Baal Shem Tov. It was a letter that it was addressed to his brother-in-law, who at the time was in the land of Israel. There's a very complicated literary history of this particular letter. There's a number of copies of it, a number of versions of it. I'm not going to go into all that. A lot of scholars have written about it. I'm bringing here a portion of this letter in the translation that I published in my book, A Hasidic Commentary on the Torah. So the Baal Shem Tov in this letter recounts that some years before that, on Rosh Hashanah of the year 1746, I took an oath for a soul ascent, Aliyat Neshama. And what the Baal Shem Tov recounts here is a mystical experience in which he ascended on high. And he emphasizes here that everything that he saw can't be expressed in. He asked the Messiah, when are you going to come? And the Messiah answered him. And here we have a key phrase that was adopted by many Hasidim in subsequent generations. He asked the Messiah, when you're going to come? And he said, by this shall you know, when your teaching will become famed and revealed throughout the world, when your wellsprings will flow forth, then that will bring messianic times. In other words, the promise that the Baal Shem Tov receives from the Messiah himself is that when Hasidic teaching comes to fill the world, then the Messiah will come. So the Baal Shem Tov, when he hears this, first he's dismayed, because how will such a thing ever happen? How long, how many centuries will that take? But then he realizes that it's really not so difficult, that he has to become a teacher and he has to become a spiritual guide and mentor. And in effect, all of his students and his disciples and his followers and anyone who learns Hasidic teaching in all of the generations to come participate in that messianic vision. That it's a powerful insight that the Baal Shem Tov was sort of granted in a moment of favor. And as we'll see, or as you will be able to see when you're able to look at my source sheet, this becomes a very, very powerful sort of influence in subsequent years, in which many generations of Hasidim sort of take up this task of spreading the wellsprings, of bringing Hasidic teaching further into the world, teaching, learning, and joining Hasidic communities. I'm just going to skip quite a few sources because we've lost a lot of time, and I really apologize again for the internet problems. I'd like to sort of go on to my next point here. We talked about one important historical source, which is this Holy Epistle. A second source which gives us insight onto the Baal Shem Tov and his circle of disciples is a collection of stories about the Baal Shem Tov called Shivchei Habesht. It's a hagiographic source. In other words, it tells stories about the greatness of its major figure, which is the Baal Shem Tov. But in effect, it's a fascinating source because historians over the decades have mined this collection of stories in order to find historical information about various figures. What interests us here is the personal dynamic that we can detect in the stories between the Baal Shem Tov and those who knew him. So there are two stories that I've brought you here in this section. One of them is from one of the Baal Shem Tov's followers called Reb Nachman of Horodenka. And this is the story he tells. He says, when I was a great chassid, I would go daily to immerse in a mikveh so cold that no one else in the generation could bear it. But still, I was unable to free myself of foreign thoughts until at last I discovered the Baal Shem Tov's wisdom. Interesting story. Reb Nachman of Horodenka describes himself as a great chassid, meaning a chassid of the old style, as we talked about last week. These are the chassidim before the Baal Shem Tov, who practiced asceticism, mortification, purification, very, very stern and unforgiving practices. But what Reb Nachman of Horodenka admits here is that none of that did any good. He still was troubled by alien thoughts, by distractions that kept him from learning and from praying as he wanted to, until the Baal Shem Tov saved him from that. Now, as we know, I'm not going to go into it right now, but the Baal Shem Tov had a very important teaching about foreign thoughts, alien thoughts that distracted people from holiness, which was that they need to be transformed and one needs to rechannel them rather than trying to repress them. So what we have here is a more forgiving view on human weaknesses and foibles that in effect, if they're recognized and if they're seen with kindness, a person is able to not only overcome them, but use them to the good. I'm skipping here. I'd like to go on to my third, to a third point here, which is a very important point in understanding the Baal Shem Tov and his presence and his agency, which is that the Baal Shem Tov didn't write. Aside from that one letter the epistle that we just read, there are no written records that the Baal Shem Tov himself took care of his own teachings. Now, this story that I'd like to look with you at with you now touches on this point, and I'd like to sort of question it. Why is it that the Baal Shem Tov's teaching was oral rather than written? So here's the story. As I heard from the rabbi of our community, there was a man who wrote down teachings he had heard from the Baal Shem Tov. Once the Baal Shem Tov caught sight of a demon walking along holding a book. And he asked him, "What's that book you're carrying?" The demon answered, "It's the book you composed." Then the Baal Shem Tov understood that someone was transcribing his Torah teachings. He called all his people together and challenged them. "Who among you has been writing down my words?" The guilty one admitted it and handed over his writings. The Baal Shem Tov read them and declared, "There isn't a single word here that I said." Okay, so it's a humorous story. It's sort of ironic. What are we supposed to understand from it? So what I'd like to suggest is that, in effect, the Baal Shem Tov's teaching was a living teaching. It was one that was related to the personal needs, search, and desire of the people who are learning from him. It was a teaching that couldn't be written down and fixed in words, because then it wouldn't be personal. It wouldn't be able to arouse the person that he was trying to reach. Now, paradoxically, of course, like the Torah Shebaal Peh, our oral teaching, it also was a teaching that was transmitted from teacher to student. And at some point, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi decided that it had to be written down, because if it wouldn't be written down, it would be forgotten. for Hasidic teaching, you know, we have the same sort of paradox, and I'd like to carry over the same resolution of it, that although it's a teaching that's written down, it has to remain oral in the sense that it demands or requires personal engagement. In other words, Hasidic teaching isn't something you can just pick up like a philosophical tract and read it, get the message, understand it intellectually, and go on. It's the kind of teaching that needs to be ruminated on, contemplated, digested, reflected on, because if it doesn't have personal meaning, it's not a teaching that's going to change your life. And in effect, that's what the Baal Shem Tov was interested in, which was changing the lives of the people who knew him. Okay, so now in the next section here, if you have the sources, I'm down to number three, the Baal Shem Tov circle. I would like to, in the framework of this course, relate only to two figures in his circle. They're probably the two major figures. One is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Kona, and the second is the Magid of Mezrich, Dov Ber. I'd like to first devote a few words to this idea of the Baal Shem Tov circle and what exactly that means. So as we know, maybe as we don't know, but I'll tell you, there are many myths about or misconceptions about Hasidism in this early stage. Historians now have come more or less to the agreement that the Baal Shem Tov did not found a movement. He didn't have hundreds of thousands of followers. He didn't have a court. And he was a figure who very few people knew about. The circle of people who learned from him were many of them Kabbalists. Others of them were Torah scholars. Most of them belonged to a spiritual elite, and they were teachers in their own right. Many of them had communities. They had followers of their own. They came to the Baal Shem Tov, many of them for short periods of time, and went back to their own communities. And in general, they were on a very high level of learning and scholarship. And they were few in number, like 10 or 20, perhaps a few more than that. So we're talking about a circle of people who had various connections over various periods of time with the Baal Shem Tov. Perhaps we could say what distinguishes or the common factor of all of them is that they had a personal connection to the Baal Shem Tov. They received from him personally and he affected them. And that is what won them the status that they have of being members of his circle. The first figure that I'd like to present is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonoi. He was a rabbi, and before he became a chassid, a follower of the Baal Shem Tov, he was indeed a chassid of the old school. There are stories about his first encounter with the Baal Shem Tov, but nothing that we can rely on historically. But the Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, perhaps more than any other of the Baal Shem Tov's followers, recorded his teachings. We have many, many teachings that we have no other source for them aside from his writings. And in fact, even the Holy Epistle was first published in Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's book. He published the first book of Hasidic teachings in 1781. On our source sheet here, I present just a few really short teachings by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. I'd like to skip the first two of them and just move on to the third one. It's on four, in case you have the papers in front of you. It appears in his book, Todot Yaakov Yosef. And Rabbi Yaakov Yosef reflects on a teaching by the Baal Shem Tov in the Pirkei Avot. The teaching is Ezehu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam. Why? One who learns something from every person. Now, what the Baal Shem, what Rabbi Yaakov Yosef? Sorry.
Mute.
Ah, yes. Could everybody please mute themselves? Thank you. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, it relates. I heard in the name of my master on the Mishnah, Who is wise? One who learns something from every person. The Baal Shem Tov compared this to what happens when one looks in a mirror and sees every single blemish on one's own face, of course. So it is when you perceive the flaws of others, know that you yourself have something of them. Okay, so what is he trying to say here? In the Mishnah, I guess on a simple reading would be that wisdom is attained by being attentive to other people and learning from them. One would think learning wisdom from them, learning a positive example from them, etc. Things that we would consider as something worthwhile learning. What the Baal Shem Tov taught here in this, according to his student, was a paradoxical kind of reflection. When you look at other people and you see their flaws, their mistakes, their errors, their sins, you should know that Hashem is showing you those flaws so that you can understand your own. In other words, look at other people as if you were looking in a mirror and understand what it is that you have to repair by seeing them. I think it's a radical kind of alternative vision because, of course, what is so much easier for us to do is to see the flaws of others and critique others, to focus our attention on them and what they are doing wrong and what they need to repair. By reversing the vision and seeing oneself in another, first of all, it gives us a much more compassionate kind of vision of the world, because in effect, everything is turned back to us. If we want to repair the world or we want to repair others, the best place to start is with ourselves. It's certainly an insight that a psychologist could tell us, but by connecting it to this Mishnah, I think that the Baal Shem Tov was sort of trying to enact a kind of transformative kind of reading too. Any kind of vision that we want to, or an insight that we want to have on our sources, we need to try to understand it much more closely. What are the potentialities of reading? Beyond the simple meaning, what other kind of understanding we might be able to gain if we're just honest and self-reflective and willing to engage in the process of self-transformation. I'd like to move on now to the second figure that's going to concern us today. The second major figure who was a disciple of Baal Shem Tov, that's Rabbi Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezrich. Perhaps more significantly, after the Baal Shem Tov's death, the Magid of Mezrich became one of the major figures in promulgating Hasidic teaching. He sent missionary, I guess you could say, to many parts of the Jewish world in order to spread Hasidic teaching. And he's a major figure also in developing Hasidic teaching in his own unique way. The story that I'd like to read with you, I think it's a very interesting story and has a lot to teach us about the Baal Shem Tov's interpersonal relationships. I've translated the second part of the story, but the first two paragraphs I didn't translate. So I'd like to just sort of summarize them with you, and then we'll move on to my English translation here at the top of the page. We're on page 4, AB. And this story also appears in a number of, in two different, two major versions. One of them in Shivchei Baal Shem Tov, and the second version is the one we're looking at here in Keter Shem Tov. So the story starts out like this. The Magid of Mezrich was a big Torah scholar, and he heard rumors about the Baal Shem Tov. He heard that people were traveling to the Baal Shem Tov, and he heard that people were singing the praises of the Baal Shem Tov. Now, Reb Dov Ber at the time was not a Hasid, and he decided that he wanted to go to the Baal Shem Tov and test him. He traveled to him kedei lenesoto, to test him, to see if the Baal Shem Tov was really as great as everyone held him to be. Now, Reb Dov Ber was a big Talmid Chacham, and he went out, he started on the journey, and rather soon he became uncomfortable because he couldn't learn the way he wanted to. Here he was traveling all day long. And so he was already getting in a bad mood. By the time he even got to Mezhebuzh, he regretted that he had set out on this endeavor. Now he got to the Baal Shem Tov in the second paragraph, and he met him. And what happened, the Baal Shem Tov started telling him stories. He told him the story of the wagon driver who was driving, and he didn't have money. He didn't have food to give to his to the wagon driver, and then he didn't have straw to give to the horse. The Baal Shem Tov told him story after story, and Reb Dov Ber, his estimation of the Baal Shem Tov just sunk lower and lower. Why in the world is he telling me all these stories? Here I am, a Torah scholar, and he's dealing with meaningless details of peasant life. A second paragraph, it's four lines down. But of course, Reb Dov Ber didn't realize that in all of these stories, there was secret hidden wisdom. In any case, Reb Dov Ber returns to his to the inn in the evening. He's totally frustrated and disgusted with the whole situation. And he says to his own wagon driver, "We're leaving, we're going home." Now he tells the wagon driver, "We're going home right now." And they start to get ready. And by the time they're ready, it's midnight. And just then the Baal Shem Tov summons him. Go back up to my English translation here in the middle of the page. He was about to set off on the journey home, and the Baal Shem Tov sent his servant to summon him. So the Magid came to the Baal Shem Tov, and the Baal Shem Tov asked the Magid, "Can you learn?" Meaning, can you learn Torah? "Yes," he answered. "Indeed," the Baal Shem Tov said, "I've heard that you can learn." Then he asked, "Do you know anything of the wisdom of the Kabbalah?" Now, of course, the Magid was a big mystic. He knew all about Kabbalah. "I do," said the Magid. So the Baal Shem Tov showed him a passage in Etz Chaim, the book by Rabbi Yitzchak Uloya. The Magid said, "Let me take the book for a time to study it." He then told the Baal Shem Tov the plain sense, the pshat of the passage. And the Baal Shem Tov responded, "You understand nothing." The Magid considered the passage once again, and he repeated, "The plain meaning is as I have said. If your honor knows a different meaning, tell it to me, and we shall see with whom the truth is found." "Stand up," said the Baal Shem Tov. The Magid stood up. Now the names of several angels were in that passage, and as he spoke them, the whole house was filled with light. Fire surrounded them, and the angels appeared right there before them. The Baal Shem Tov said to him, "True. The pshat was as you said, but your learning was without any soul." At once the Magi told his servant to go back home, and he remained with the Baal Shem Tov to learn his profound and secret wisdom. Okay, so now the question is what we are to learn from this story, what it tells us about the Baal Shem Tov, about his presence, and I guess my most important question about the way that he conveyed his teachings. So there are a couple of points I'd like to make. First of all, as we see, the Magid comes to the Baal Shem Tov from a position of pride, self-confidence. He's a Torah scholar, and he, at the beginning, is, I guess you could say, pretty much in opposition of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov presents himself with great humility. He purposely tells him stories that have no apparent meaning. They're not worthy of a Torah scholar. Interestingly, what's central motifs in these stories are human needs. The story talks about people who need to eat, about people who have horses that need their straw, and all of this has profound and secret wisdom. Now, the Magi doesn't get it. To the extent that when he comes back to the inn again, he tells his own servant in the middle of the night, instead of letting his servant sleep, he says to him, "Let's get everything together. We're going home in the middle of the night," which is certainly not a human kind way of relating to his servant. Now, when the Baal Shem Tov calls him and summons him, he enables the Magi to show his wisdom. But in the end, he compels him to realize that his learning is intellectual without a soul. Now, interestingly, I think that what convinces the Magid of the Baal Shem Tov's greatness is that the teaching he's offering is not just an intellectual abstract teaching. It's an experiential teaching. There's fire and light and angels. Something's happening in this teaching, something alive that affects the people learning. It's symbolic, I would say, of the Baal Shem Tov's overall agenda, which is whatever it is that you're learning, you're not supposed to be learning with your head. You're supposed to be learning with your heart. And in effect, we see sort of as the catharsis of the story that the Magid goes back to the inn and he enables his servant to go. He enables him to tend to his own physical human needs. And the Magid, in humility, remains with the Baal Shem Tov and becomes his disciple. I guess one other question I'd just like to raise or to point out, what's interesting and important in this story is the dialogue, that we have a meeting really between speaking, thinking individuals. The message of the story comes to the fore through this meeting, through this connection. And in effect, I guess we could say, I mean, as we know, the much of Hasidic teaching is framed in the form of stories. So the question that I'd like to turn to now is, what is it about stories that have this power to convey meaning? In other words, if we compare the stories to other forms of communication, there are characteristics that are unique. What are they, right? So I would maybe, let's, in order to introduce this last point, I'd like to look at two teachings. One of them is a parable that appears in one of the works that of the Magid of Mezgich, in which I think we'll just move on to the second one because I don't have a lot of time. Okay, I'm going back down to my final point, number four, storytelling. As we'll see, the Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy presents this Talmudic story in his own teaching. I'd like to look at the story itself first. Okay, so there's a story in the Talmud, in Masechet Ta'anit, which tells of one of the rabbis, Rabbi Baroka Hosea, who was often found in the marketplace of Bei Lefet. In the marketplace, he has a number of encounters with Elijah, in which he asks Elijah, Mikan ben Olam Abba, who here in this marketplace is worthy of the world to come, right? And in the Gemara, there are a number of people who are pointed out, and in which Elijah says to this sage, this person is worthy of the world to come. Among the people, here if you see in the second paragraph, this is the translation of the Gemara itself, two brothers came to the marketplace. Elijah said to Rabbi Baroka, these two have a share in the world to come. So Rabbi Baroka went over to the men and said to them, what's your occupation? They said to him, we are jesters, and we cheer up the depressed. Alternatively, when we see two people who have a quarrel between them, we strive to make peace. It is said that for this behavior, one enjoys the profits of his actions in this world, and yet his reward is not diminished in the world to come. Okay, so these two people, these jesters, they are called badchanim. It sounds strange. What is it about them that gives them such merit? So they point out two things. First, they cheer up people who are sad. And secondly, they make peace between people who are arguing. In keeping this in mind, I move now to this Hasidic teaching by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the last one on your page. It's connected to a verse that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef is interpreting. Moshe spoke to Hashem and said, "May Hashem, God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the assembly, who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall take them out and bring them in. And let the assembly of Hashem not be like sheep who have no shepherd." Rabbi Yaakov Yosef relates in the name of the Baal Shem Tov on this verse. And he says, "For the leader of the generation is empowered to raise up all the world, all the words, and all the stories of the people of his time, to rejoin the physical to the spiritual, like those two gestures. And so he taught." Here we have, I guess it's not really a story, but it talks about stories, that the Baal Shem Tov believed that by telling stories, it was possible to reunite or to create unity between things that had fallen asunder, that had fallen apart. Again, we have here an alternative sort of way of communicating, rather than presenting things in an abstract, linear, intellectual form. The Baal Shem Tov told stories and enabled people to connect the dots, to create something unified where there had been something incomprehensible. In order to understand the story, we have to be able to bring ourselves to it. And so I guess that's the point I would like to end with, that the teachings that the Baal Shem Tov introduced in the name of Hasidism were teachings directed toward personal growth, personal transformation and change. And perhaps one reason that they had the transformative effect that they did was that they required people to engage with them. It's a big task, but I think that because the Baal Shem Tov was a teacher who had this presence, the warmth, the charisma that enabled him to communicate with people on a personal level, that was the secret, I guess, to his a presence not only in their lives, but in the lives of generations to come. Okay, thank you. I'd be happy to hear if anyone has any questions or comments. I apologize again for the disconnectedness of this shiur. I hope next week we'll do better. Yes, AJ, would you like to? Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was really interesting. One question, and I know very little of Kabbalah, but when you're in your in the meeting of the Magid, first meeting and initial meeting, you spoke about secret wisdom. And I always thought the Kabbalah had secret wisdom. So my question is the difference that in the Kabbalah, the secret wisdom was still only mostly apprehended via the cognitive, via thinking, and what is new is the importance of emotions and the experiential? So that's my question.
That's an excellent question. Okay, first of all, we could say that in effect, the esoteric wisdom is esoteric because not everybody understands it. In other words, it's something that's transmitted from mouth to ear that only an elite have access to it. Now, that, I guess that's one definition, I suppose, of Kabbalah. I think that we have certain few people, spiritual elite, who are party to that secret wisdom. But in effect, if you think about it, secret wisdom is really only usable if it's not secret anymore. So we have this paradoxical mixture of things that emerge from a very, very high place in terms of their spirituality, in terms of their holiness, but somehow they're translated in a way that they don't lose their holiness while becoming accessible. And that, I guess, is the gift that the Baal Shem Tov had, that he was able to preserve this aura of holiness while giving people some kind of a sense that they had a grasp on it.
Thank Can I you. Say something? Hello?
Yes, Friedman, yes.
I wrote on my in responding to your question, who influenced this, be of what qualities? I wrote Rav Shlomo, and I'm upset that I understand many of the tyness, many of the questions brought against him in how he may have insulted women or done worse, who knows what. But for me, that kind of personal embodiment of all the things the Besh stood for, stories, songs, the experiential, knowing Torah, but bringing it to the level of, I happen to be a product of a yeshiva, 16 years, Torah Vadas, and I was losing it. And just to have discovered him in the village in 1960s, in the six, it was a restoration project for me, a way of getting back to everything I kind of sort of thought I knew and was beginning to throw away, and how he redistributed, remade my kishkis, my inner being, made him my Rebbe, followed him wherever, et cetera, and I learned from him. I wonder who might qualify now for being that kind of a accelerator or of being a master. Some people say, you know, the old Lubavitcher Shul Rebbe was that, and other people have their Rebbes, but they're very personal, and they don't really cut across a variety of disciplines and personalities and continents. I hope we can find a way of resurrecting it, not just his music and his stories, but the influence and seek that out. I don't know where I'm going with this. I just miss him. You brought back some of that language to me by talking about the Besh and Yaakov Yosef and the other Magid Mimezbich. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's Shlomo Carlebach. I think that he very consciously modeled himself on the Baal Shem Tov in terms of presence and agency and charisma. Sure. I mean, you know, it's, I think different people seek a master in different ways. And I think that was really one of the things I was getting at in the beginning, at the beginning of the shiur, that we all have our rebbes, you know, whether it's our grandmother or our fifth grade teacher. We're looking for that kind of personality who can come into our life and channel us in the direction that we want to go. So, you know, if some of us had the merit of actually knowing a Rebbe, but I think, and actually I wrote about this in my book, in the Hasidic commentary, that good teachers have many of the qualities of a Hasidic Rebbe, even if they don't know a lot about Hasidut, because they summon us to reconsider ourselves, our path, to reconnect, you know, to Hashem. So yes, anybody, Susanna? Yes.
Just a comment. You were talking about the stories, and among Native American healers, they have, you know, their ways of healing. They have their herbs. They have their this, that, and the other thing, but they also have their stories. And I heard at a presentation once about somebody saying how one of them was saying how telling the story while you're giving whatever treatment that you're giving, the story itself is part of the healing. So I find, you know, it's interesting comparison.
Absolutely. No, there's been quite a lot written, you know, in the therapeutic context about the importance of stories. I absolutely didn't do it justice in this year. I was planning to say many things that I didn't get to, but yes, it's something that's trans, you know, across cultures and generations. Excellent point. Yes.
I wanted to ask something, and my name is Chaya. That's my husband's name up there. I may be getting ahead of this, and I know the course has many more sessions to go. We know that the Vilna Gaon was one of the great opposers to Hasidism in general, and yet we know that he was a great Talmud of Kabbalah, as probably all the great scholars were. Do you, I don't know if, I've never read a lot on this, so was there ever an idea that he proposed that one of the problems, I know that he's, some of the problems he found, was that of the popularization of this esoteric knowledge that was meant to be for the great intellectuals? And maybe the further question, and maybe you'll do this in the future, is there such a danger? Was there a danger? Has there been difficulties with the popularization of Kabbalistic ideas by people who don't really understand what they're about and maybe even abuse or misuse them?
Excellent question. I actually, there another participant here asked me for some references on the Gaon, and unfortunately, that's Irene. Yeah, I don't have. You didn't give me the your email address didn't work, so I sent you a whole message, but it came back to me. Anyone who would like me to send them material, just please send me an email message. I wrote my. I'll give you my email address again, and if you write to me, then I'll answer you back. And so in answer to your question, yes, there have been a couple of books written about the Gaon and his opposition to Hasidism. And the first scholar, Mordechai Vilensky, actually noted that as one of the Gaon's major contentions against the Hasidism, that they popularized Kabbalah. So, and in fact, Nefesh HaChaim, one of his main objectives, the student of the Gaon, was to counter that popularization by presenting Kabbalah in a different way, which would enable people to access it, because the Gaon or the Reb Chaim saw the need of the generation. The generation was interested in Kabbalah, and Nefesh HaChaim is an attempt to offer that insight into the world of Kabbalah without making people resort to Hasidism. So yes, it's a fascinating sort of a dynamic, mutually fruitful and very interesting.
Thank you.
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Yes, have you noticed any parallel inferences between the life of the Besht and the life of Jesus and stories in the New Testament which parallel to some degree the criticism of the rabbis who were steeped in ritual law and a feeling of a greater connection to people and the needs of ordinary human beings. It almost seems to me as if Hasidism is a rebirth in some way of the early Christian belief of changing the law into or changing the nature of which Jews approach their God from what Chazal has to say about halacha and a more spiritual approach, a more inner approach from the heart rather than the law.
Absolutely, yes. So first of all, there is a scholar, Shaul Magid, has written a lot about comparing early Christianity to Hasidism. You can look and see, or I can look for some references for that as well. But definitely the whole institutional sort of or social critique, one of the main spokesmen of that was actually Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the student of the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, that much of his works, especially Todot Yaakov Yosef, is devoted to social criticism. So yes, the parallels are there, and it's an important association. But yes, it's been there are quite a few people who have written about that. Yeah. All right. So thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing comments that you've written, and I apologize again for the technical disorders here. We'll see you next week. I'll put in a special prayer that my internet should hold up this time. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.